you guys, most of you who have been here, may have heard some of today's shiur a couple of weeks ago. If so, I apologize, but because of the new group,
Those are all the regulars. There's Avi, where's Josh? Yehuda.
Vote that all cell phones should have the vibrator.
Yes.
So I have mine on. It's on vibrate. It doesn't have to bother
just put
anybody.
Put it on silent. It's very simple.
What's silent do?
Silent, what it does is the phone will still ring, but you can't hear it. And it'll take a message, and then when you're done with class, you look at it.
So did you turn it off? It won't do the same thing?
Well, you turn it off, then you gotta turn it back on. With silent, it's still on.
Okay. When Jews decide to explore traditional Judaism, I think there's usually an assumption, if not explicit, then it's in the back of people's minds, that since I'm Jewish, and since this is Judaism, it should be familiar. It should feel natural. The ideas should sound intuitive. The values should be easy to relate to. That assumption guarantees that there'll be a shock, because traditional Judaism is really quite different from what contemporary Western secular society prepares you for. The contemporary West is either Christian or post-Christian, and when people speak of the Judeo-Christian heritage, that's sort of like talking about the political system called democratic communism, which is a contradiction. So the Jew who has been acculturated to a Christian or post-Christian climate and then makes an exploration of Judaism is in for a shock. Considerable number of the ideas, the values, the practices will be very foreign. And I would say upsettingly foreign, because one would like to feel close and comfortable and feel that one has a natural relationship with what a Jew regards as the historical roots of his existence. It's a little bit like an anthropologist who is investigating a new culture, only the anthropologist is forewarned. He's going in order to do that, whereas the Jew is not forewarned. Now, anthropologists know that when you are investigating a new culture, you are likely to see things, hear things, experience things that are very difficult to understand. And there is a rule that they follow to try to improve understanding, facilitate understanding. And that rule is fill in the appropriate context. Don't take something out of its context. And the context has at least three different dimensions. There's the context of appropriate facts, the context of appropriate beliefs, and the context of appropriate values. You see the natives doing something. The first question you have to ask is, well, if they're doing this now, what did they do before, and what did they do afterwards? How does this fit into the physical facts, the legal facts, psychological facts? Secondly, you can't understand what their activities mean to them unless you appreciate how they look at it. And how they look at it includes their beliefs about what they're doing and also their values. Only when you fill in the appropriate context of facts, beliefs, and values do you have a hope of understanding what you see and being able, therefore, to evaluate it. I want to illustrate this rule briefly with three trivial examples, just so you get a feeling for how the rule works. And then I want to take you through a number of terrible mistakes in understanding traditional Judaism where people did not follow the rule. This is all by way of a cautionary tale over the next 3 weeks. When you come across, I won't say if, but when you come across things that are weird, you will exercise caution and look to fill in the appropriate context. So let's start with the appropriate background of facts. Someone from the interior of Australia, an Aborigine, is taken to Sydney. And he is given a tour of an operating theater in a hospital. And he watches surgery. Now this guy is wheeled in on a table and they put a mask over his face, which obviously interferes with his breathing because he goes unconscious. And then they cut him with knives and remove some flesh from the inside and then they sew him up with needle and thread. What is this? Is this what they do with political dissidents? Some kind of torture chamber? Of course, if he will fill in the facts of surgery, he'll understand that the person was suffering some kind of physical ailment, then this is going to improve his health. But if he doesn't know that, there's no way that he can appreciate what he sees. Imagine a visitor from Indonesia coming to the United States. Let's imagine that there has been a threat to the security of the United States, and the president is ruling by decree, which, as I understand, the American law allows him to do for 60 days in an emergency situation. And he lands there on day 16. And he sees there's this one man who gives orders, and everybody obeys, and the police enforce it. So he naturally concludes that it's a dictatorship. But he's making a big mistake. It's really a democracy with a democratically passed law that says, under conditions of national emergency, the president can temporarily rule by decree. If he doesn't know the background of legal facts, he cannot understand what he sees. The pyramids in Egypt are phenomenal mausoleums where they buried the pharaohs. Many of them were provided with food, clothing, weapons, sometimes a little ship. Why were those goods put in this mausoleum? Was it a way of creating scarcity to raise prices? Or was it somehow a superstition that when the person dies, he can't use his goods anymore? Now, as a matter of fact, they believed that this mummified person will live again. And of course, if he lives, he's going to have to eat. And clothes will be very useful. And he'll have to fight enemies, so he needs weapons. And he'll have to go across a river, so he needs a boat. This is a way of providing for the future needs of the buried person. If you don't know that, if you don't know what they believed about what they were doing, you cannot appreciate what they were doing. Every society practices censorship. There is no society without censors. So if I tell you that such and such a country has a board of censors, I've told you nothing, because every country has that. The question is, for the sake of what values do they censor material? Some censor in order to protect national security. Some censor in order to keep the current powers in power, to stifle opposition. And there are others who censor for a wide variety of purposes, In some societies, they censor in order to protect the dignity of women. So they cut out pornography. So in order to understand the censorship in a society, you have to know the values that that practice serves. So this is the rule. In order to understand something, you have to fill in the relevant background of facts, beliefs, and values. Now, as I said, I'm going to give you illustrations of what failure to obey this rule can lead to in understanding traditional Judaism. I'm interested in sharing with you failures. I'm not interested at the moment in correcting all the failures. Most of these will be dealt with in Shiurim over the next 2.5 weeks, and if not, you can always ask and get the answers. I just want now to illustrate and impress you with the need for filling in this kind of background. There is a law, a Jewish law, that says a woman who is menstruating cannot have relations with her husband, or actually with any other male, she's not married. After she stops menstruating, she has to have 7 days without appearance of blood, and then she can go to a mikveh. A mikveh is a pool of water, satisfying certain conditions, and she immerses herself in the pool, and then she can resume having relations with her husband. Now, why is that? What's that all about? So if you look in the wrong circles, here's what you'll be told. Judaism regards women as dirty, polluted, inferior, second-class citizens. And therefore, when they menstruate, they have to be cut off. And then in order to rejoin the august company of their husbands, then they have to go to mikveh. Mikveh is a way of cleansing yourself of this pollution, which makes you into a second-class citizen. Well, let's just take account of some of the relevant legal facts, the legal background. On Yom Kippur, the high priest in the temple goes to mikveh 5 times. I'll remind you that the high priest is male, not female. Right? And during the service, he goes to mikveh 5 times. Should I conclude that on Yom Kippur, the high priest is a fifth-class citizen because he has to go to mikveh 5 times? Or that he's dirty or polluted? It's probably not the right interpretation, certainly not in a male chauvinist religion, right? Furthermore, in terms of biblical law, most of which isn't enforced today, but the original structure of Jewish law, when a man has a seminal emission, he too has to go to mikveh. And in normal life, that happens considerably more frequently than a woman's menstruation. Hasidic men, you know, those are the most right-wing, ultra-Orthodox, medieval, superstitious ignoramuses, among whom I count myself. Hasidic men go to mikveh every day. I go to mikveh every morning. Does that mean I regard myself as 30 times as polluted as my wife? And I'm still going after my wife stopped menstruating. After she went through menopause, I'm still going to mikveh. It does seem there's something wrong with this interpretation. Because the legal facts were not consulted. They took a single fact out of its context. When you put it back into the context, you see that this can't be the right interpretation. As I said, I'm not going to talk about the right interpretation today. I want you to see what goes wrong if you don't fill in the context.
I'm just curious, is a woman allowed to go more than once a month to the mikveh?
A person's allowed to go, yeah, sure. I mean, there's no prohibition.
Not during the time that she's impure, though.
Allowed means there's no rule against it, it just won't do her any good. You know, it won't purify her. But a person can physically pay you money and you go, and they'll take your money. They'll think you haven't broken any law. If you go, it just doesn't do you any good. Let's try another one. Yom Kippur, a day of 25 hours of absolute fasting, and no bathing, and you don't wear leather shoes, what's going on? Well, anthropology has a category for this. It's called self-flagellation. I guess in the contemporary vernacular, they'd call it beating up on yourself. Why? Because these primitive people believe that they have angered the gods and are therefore in danger of supernatural punishment. And by hurting themselves, they preclude, they prevent being hurt by the gods. That's the anthropologist category. But it doesn't apply to Yom Kippur. It's not relevant to Yom Kippur. Because the normal, healthy, traditional Jew who believes in Yom Kippur does not feel hungry or thirsty. 25 hours and he doesn't feel hungry or thirsty. It just doesn't come into his consciousness. Now, that probably sounds fantastic to you. How could that be? 25 hours without eating and drinking? Let me make contact with some experiences that you may have had to show you how this works. Let's imagine that it's the last 3 minutes of the Super Bowl. Are you likely to get up and get a Coke? Or are you likely to be glued to the screen? You and 100 million, well, no, probably more than that, huh? 500 million, a billion people, right? How many of the hundreds of millions of people watching the Super Bowl will get up in the last 3 minutes and go get a Coke?
It's a blowout, everybody.
It's a blowout, right. Next to none, right? Now, you're going to tell me that there's hundreds of millions of people, nobody got thirsty? What's the chance that of hundreds of millions of people that no one will get thirsty during those 3 minutes? Zero. Except that you won't feel the thirst. Because you're glued to the screen. And when you're glued to the screen, the thirst doesn't make it into your conscious mind. You don't experience thirst. I can guarantee you, as soon as it's over, there's a break for the refrigerator, for the Coke, for the whatever people are drinking. I told some of you, in sports, you don't feel the pain until after the game. My last wrestling match, I broke the big toe, my left foot. But I didn't feel any pain until it was over. My leg stopped working, but I didn't feel any pain. And I won the match. I won the match on points. But I couldn't walk off the mat. I only felt the pain afterwards. Often in sports, you don't know you're injured until after the game. If a Jew knows that he has Yom Kippur once a year, and this is his one chance to clean his slate, and he can start the year with a clean slate, it's a phenomenal opportunity. And he's conscious of the spiritual transformation that that requires. Food and drink just don't enter his consciousness. Now, it can't be self-punishment if you don't feel any pain. That's just the wrong category. This is not rolling in the snow or rolling on beds of needles or sticking yourself with burning coals. Because here there isn't an experience of pain. And by the way, if the purpose were a matter of pain, then you would surely find some extraordinarily pious individuals who would add to the pain, stick themselves with needles or lay themselves out in the sun and bake or something like that. There is no such requirement. There is no such praiseworthy voluntary performance. We sit in the air-conditioned synagogues and the seats are as comfortable as possible. There's no, indeed, one thing that some of the younger people do, or the children, they put together combinations of spices and hand them around for people to be able to smell the spices and to make a blessing on the spices. So there is no question of adding to pain, discomfort, and suffering. But here, the anthropologist's interpretation is going to be incompetent because of the relevant psychological facts. Another example. If you don't know it already, you'll know it soon. Any issue upon which the Talmud gives a decision, that decision is final and absolute. It cannot be challenged. It It's final and absolute. Now, why is that? After all, time marches on. People do discover new ideas. They can incorporate what the Talmud said and make progress beyond it. Why should it be that what the Talmud says is absolute and cannot be challenged? Again, if you're in the wrong environment, the wrong circles, here's what they'll tell you. Traditional Jews believe that everything in the past is better than everything in the present. People in the past were more pious, more holy, more spiritual, smarter, better scholars, more dedicated, more courageous. So, anything that was decided in the past is beyond critique. It's beyond critique, it's beyond investigation, you just take it as a given. All you have to do is attack unresolved problems or new applications to new realities. But the past that's been decided is written in stone. That's what they'll tell you. But it's a mistake.